Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Three Democratic presidential candidates head out of the New Hampshire primary and into the next nomination contests with the wind at their backs. Bernie Sanders won here in the Granite State, but just barely, with 26% of the vote. Pete Buttigieg was close behind with 24%, and Amy Klobuchar in third place with 20%. Elizabeth Warren came in a faraway fourth place with just 9%. Meanwhile, Joe Biden's fortunes tumbled last night, coming in fifth with 8%. Today in The Exchange, what happened and why and where this race goes from here. We'd love your reactions. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe. James, it is great to see you. Thank
this
you for being
so
here.
This is so much fun.
Well, really appreciate it. I know it was a long night and a long day. And Andy Smith, same to you. I'm very grateful that you're here. Director of the UNH Survey Center, professor of practice in political science at UNH. Thanks a lot, Andy.
Always a pleasure.
Well, so James, where does this Democratic nomination contest stand now after last night's primary?
Well, look, you know, the classic adage is that Iowa gives three tickets to continue on. And I'm not sure exactly what Iowa did this time. We'll still evaluate that for a while. But
we'll
New Hampshire.
We'll find out in 2 weeks or so.
Yeah. But New Hampshire certainly gave three tickets to ride to continue on. You know, obviously, this is a very good night for Bernie Sanders. Fun fact of the day as we wake up this morning, Bernie Sanders now has the record for the largest percentage win and the smallest percentage win in the New Hampshire primary. And of course, they're 4 years apart. Clearly different races, a two-person race when he got 60% of the vote, and then obviously well under 30% last night in a multi-candidate field. Others will continue on without the kind of momentum that they need. That would be, of course, Joe Biden, which is just a stunning statement if you want to step back for a second. A vice president running never was the inevitable nominee. For a while, was long time the front runner. And then, of course, Elizabeth Warren needs to figure out where exactly she fits in this space, in this race going forward. And then at the end of that, and I got to mention it, at the end of that is Mike Bloomberg, who's going to meet him on the other side. And it's kind of a semi-trolling move this morning. First thing this morning, we get a press release from Mike Bloomberg announcing his general election campaign here in New Hampshire at the morning after the New Hampshire primary.
Okay, so Andy Smith, your big thoughts about where this all goes from here, and then we'll definitely talk some specifics.
Well, I really agree with most of the things that James says. I think the things to put on top of that, first off, that Bernie underperformed, I think, the expectations. And I think a lot of that has to do with pinning your hopes on the youth vote is a dangerous thing to do. Young people are the least likely to show up in elections, and I think we saw some of that last night. Another thing that really struck me, looking at some of the internals that we've been asking, is that Democrats were less enthusiastic than anticipated, and I think turnout was actually a little bit lower. It was record number of people, but the percentage of the registered voters wasn't a record. The enthusiasm that peaked among Democrats, frankly, about the primary back in April 2018, it dropped between Iowa and New Hampshire, and I think a lot of that had to do with Trump impeachment, the mess in Iowa, the acquittal in the impeachment by Trump's State of the Union. And there's a sense of, I think, deflation on the part of a lot of Democrats, Joe Biden being the guy that they think can unite the party, disappearing from the race really after Iowa. And that, I think, is going to be the story going forward. Related to that, this is really just the knife in the heart is when Donald Trump comes in the night before and trolls the Democrats and gets more attendance at his event than they do at any of theirs. So I think it's always a positive day for the candidates to come out because you're looking forward. You're still on a roll. Some people are dead men walking. But the Trump looming over top of this race is, I think, becoming more and more obvious for Democrats and the need to find a winner.
Well, I want to bring in a couple listener comments and then ask you guys about some of the themes that you mentioned, including Joe Biden, including Bernie Sanders, and those two more moderate candidates kind of nipping at his heels. But Sean writes us from Salem. He says, why are large segments of the media hesitant to call Bernie Sanders the front runner? Also, Sean says, why are people celebrating Klobuchar's third place and Buttigieg's second place finishes as more significant? Thirdly, Sean says, I keep seeing pundits talk about Bernie's, quote, lost support from 2016 to 2020. But can we agree that there are significant differences between these races, including the clear ideological divide between Bernie and Hillary, as well as the sheer number of people running in 2020? And on that third point, I think you just addressed that, Andy, that, yes, this is clearly a different race. There are a lot of people in this race. But to his second point, James Pindle, why are people celebrating Klobuchar's third place and Buttigieg's second place finishes, Sean feels, as more significant?
Well, I think actually, I mean, look, there's first point. Let's go to the first point. At this point, Bernie Sanders is the front runner in this race for the Democratic nomination. He is more likely to be the nominee than anyone else running. But it's a very, very complicated race. We haven't had this unsettled of a Democratic primary race since 1992. Because, of course, when Bill Clinton won, he won one out of the first, I believe, 11 states. It was a very complicated thing, though you could see how he would be the nominee walking out of New Hampshire. As for the second part, I'm not sure Buttigieg really is celebrated as much as Bernie Sanders. He clearly had a win. It was very tight. I think right now it's the two big stories of the night are Sanders' win and Amy Klobuchar's remarkable comeback. And if you want to step back for a second, this has been an odd primary. It's been an odd primary season. It finished like the surprising New Hampshire primary we're always used to, late deciders and all that. But if you really want to step back, just let's go all the way back to, I don't know, 10 days ago. If you're going to tell me that Pete Buttigieg is going to win second and get that close, and you're going to tell me that Amy Klobuchar, someone who's never really invested in New Hampshire at all because she was all about Iowa, was going to come in third and get that much of a percentage of the vote, that is a stunning development in the last week.
Well, so to Sean's point, fair enough. Senator Sanders is the front runner at this point. But the media likes to, Andy, talk about what's surprising and what's new. People expected that Senator Sanders would win this primary. But as James said, you know, Buttigieg's strength and Klobuchar's incredible comeback at the last minute were surprising and new developments.
I think they're newsier than Sanders. I would make the argument there never has been a front runner in this race at all. If you combine things like polling in the national polling in the early states, endorsements that candidates get, and the money that they're raising, there really hasn't been anybody that separated themselves from the field. And I think that right now, Sanders still has the major problem that he's not been able to unify the party. He hasn't been able to get any endorsements to speak of, certainly compared with Kamala Harris had more endorsements than Sanders has got. So these are indications that there's not unity within the party yet. It may shake out as things go forward, but there isn't yet. So because Sanders was expected to do well, and the expectations are really critical. He won so big in 2016, not because of Sanders, but it was the anti-Hillary vote, essentially. This time around, he was expected to do well. He underperformed, I think fairly significantly underperformed. Buttigieg, I think, did about what we expected, maybe a little bit better, showing that he had a good campaign organization staff built in Iowa and built here. And that, I think, is going to be the thing that the insiders within the party are going to look at going forward, because he's got broader support than any of the other candidates. And I think that's why Buttigieg is the story.
Very, very quickly, Andy explained just why this is so complicated and why there's no clear front runner. But when we walk out of New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders is now taking the lead in a number of these states. He's now the national front runner over Joe Biden in the last three or four national polls. He has the most money. So by a number of metrics, he is the front runner. It's just very slim.
Well, Sean, I really appreciate you weighing in. And Harry in Hooksett says Bernie Sanders won. But if you look at the top five vote getters, moderate candidates, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, Biden, outgained progressives, Sanders Warren, 52.5% to 35.3%. So we'll talk about that point in just a moment. Harry, thank you so much. But while we're talking about Senator Sanders, I do want to bring NHPR's Jason Moon into our conversation. He was at Senator Sanders' campaign last night. It was a long night. Jason, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. You're welcome.
Well, what was it like there, Jason?
Well, as you might imagine, folks were pretty excited to see him win. You know, I talked to a lot of folks there who were supporters in 2016. And what was interesting to me was that even though obviously the margin of victory was a much slimmer this cycle than it was 4 years ago, the attitude was different. I think in 16 people were excited that he was winning in New Hampshire, but didn't necessarily hold out a ton of hope that he would be able to secure the nomination. Last night, all of the supporters I talked to for Sanders expected him to win in New Hampshire. They also fully expect him to win the nomination. So there's just a different kind of mood, a different kind of vibe about his campaign. It's less of a protest campaign than it was in 16. You know, his supporters take it very seriously and see it as a very viable campaign to go all the way.
That's really interesting. So they're seeing this as the real deal. I want to play a little audio from last night, Jason, and then ask you about it. Here is Senator Sanders talking about no matter what happens, Democrats need to come together.
With absolute certainty, and I know I speak for every one of the Democratic candidates, is that no matter who wins, and we certainly hope it's going to be us, we are going to unite together. We are going to unite together and defeat the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country.
Again, that's Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders last night at his victory party. So, Jason Moon, how did that message of unity go over with this crowd? There has been some murmuring about some Sanders supporters who don't really want to unify with other campaigns.
Yeah, well, so there was that sort of call to party unity he made in his speech. But, you know, it was maybe just a few minutes later in that same speech where Sanders, you know, took a swipe at rivals like former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Pete Buttigieg, who finished second. Sanders said, at this point in the campaign, we are up against billionaires and candidates funded by billionaires. So calls for party unity, also still sort of making those distinctions within the Democratic field very clear for his supporters. And, you know, throughout the night, as results were coming in and they were broadcasting, you know, CNN on this huge projection screen, when images of Pete Buttigieg would show up on the screen, Sanders supporters, you know, either booed or chanted things like Wall Street Pete. So there's definitely you know, some level of animosity between some of the candidates from, or against some of the other candidates from Sanders supporters. That said, I don't know that it matches the level of 2016 when it was such a stark divide and there was only, you know, one choice to be made between two candidates. So maybe, you know, it could just be sort of what happens normally in primaries, and it may not be, you know, you may hesitate to read too much into it, but
sure.
At least at this point, you know, some Sanders supporters are not seemingly ready to be unifying with any other candidates.
Well, and Jason, hang on a minute. I want to bring Andy Smith in on this. I mean, on one hand, Andy, you know, calls for unity and then in the next breath saying Wall Street Pete or whatever. But on the other hand, it's a primary. I mean, it's not a group hug. We're supposed to be pointing out differences between these candidates so voters can choose.
And I think it's absolutely the case with Sanders because he's the only candidate that really had solid support where he had dedicated people that backed him as the candidate. The other candidates had a lot of choices. Their voters had a lot of choices of other places to go. And you didn't see voters as wedded to them as you saw Sanders supporters wedded to him, in part because of 2016. He had a real core there going forward, and in part because the progressive wing of the Democratic Party has always made up about 35 to 40% of the vote here. It tends to solidify behind a single candidate, and it really is still the fight for the more moderate, larger wing. But, you know, Sanders could win this time around because he essentially eliminated Elizabeth Warren as a contest for those support.
Well, and as Harry and Hooksett pointed out, you know, the moderate candidates outgained progressives, as Harry says, 52.5% to 35%. James Pindle, real quick.
Yeah, very quickly. if Amy Klobuchar, I mean, Amy Klobuchar is the reason why Bernie Sanders won the New Hampshire primary. Pete Buttigieg was on such a rise before Friday night. And if she had not eaten into his rise at all, and particularly with the margin this closely, I think Pete Buttigieg would have won this New Hampshire primary.
Very interesting. So, Jason, how is the campaign feeling about moving on to Nevada?
You know, they feel like they have a lot of momentum. They've been, you know, claiming victory in Iowa by dint of winning the popular vote. Now they are, you know, coming off a second straight victory. You know, history would suggest that sets up a candidate well for future contests. And, you know, basically the Sanders campaign is saying that it has the largest, the strongest sort of grassroots campaign movement, the largest ground game operation. I mean, you know, whether it delivered as much as they expected. You know, some of the numbers they were touting last night in terms of, you know, 25,000 volunteers mobilized in New Hampshire. They knocked on 850,000 doors across the state. They are feeling good about sort of taking that operation elsewhere across the country. And they're going to need it, frankly, if they're going to win. You know, Sanders' theory of the case for his campaign is that he will be able to bring out, to turn out Democrats who don't typically vote, young voters in particular. But that is very labor intensive, as those voters don't often get themselves to the polls without some encouragement.
One last question for you, Jason, please. President Trump has made it quite clear he'll enjoy putting the socialist label on Sanders and the rest of the party if Sanders is indeed the Democratic nominee. How do the Sanders people you talked to during this campaign feel about that?
You know, they don't seem too concerned about it. What a lot of people said is, well, you know, Trump will say anything about any candidate, and so we shouldn't get too hung up on what label he's going to place on Senator Sanders. And I think they also have Sanders supporters have a sense that the sort of authenticity and consistency of Sanders will sort of make him sort of untouchable in a way that other Democratic candidates might not be on a debate stage. The fact that he's also sort of an insurgent candidate who is bucking the powers that be within the party, much as Trump did within the Republican Party, sort of might make him immune to some of the typical criticisms that Trump levies. So I don't, you know, certainly in the room last night, you know, Senator Sanders supporters were not concerned about that at all.
All right. Jason Moon, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
That's NHPR's Jason Moon. He covered the Sanders campaign last night. I want to share a couple emails, and by the way, keep them coming in, exchange@nhpr.org. David in Alton says, let's not talk anymore about Democrats' quote enthusiasm. Some Democrats may not generally feel they have to show up to vote in a primary. Many don't really care who gets the nomination because they're going to vote for whichever candidate goes up against the incumbent president. So David says a lack of, quote, enthusiasm for a primary candidate should not be mistaken for a lack of commitment to vote for whoever the party puts forward in November. Thank you very much, David, for that one. We've got a bunch of other emails from listeners. Katie tweeted to ask us, any information yet on the breakout of voters by gender and age? Katie, we will check into that after a short break, and we'll keep taking your emails and calls. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, tweet us, and we'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the presidential primary. Who did well last night and who was disappointed? We'd love to hear from you, your reaction to what happened in New Hampshire. What surprised you? What pleased you? Or disappointed you? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Andy Smith, director of the UNH Survey Center, a professor of practice in political science at UNH. James Pindle is also here, political reporter for the Boston Globe. And gentlemen, let's go right to our listeners. Diane is calling in from Portsmouth. Hi, Diane. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, thank you. I am a select person for Ward 2. I worked for 14 hours at the polls yesterday. Everything went very, very smoothly. And I'm hoping that this will calm down everybody about the primary in New Hampshire not being representative of the rest of the country. My questions for Jamin and Andy are, if people who follow the campaigns, are the stump speeches that the candidates will bring to the rest of the country, do they change significantly in other parts of the country? And are the questions that people ask them so different from what we ask in New Hampshire that we're not representing the rest of the country?
Well, and Diane, thank you so much for the call. And it's a great question. What do you think, James? You travel around with these candidates.
The stump speeches change as the campaign changes, not as the state changes. So Elizabeth Warren, for example, is talking a lot now about unity. You're going to hear Bernie Sanders return to the theme of billionaires, which he started out in 2015 because he feels like there's a billionaire on the looming in Michael Bloomberg, and he feels like Pete Buttigieg's campaign has been funded, as he says, by 40 different billionaires. Of course, there's a maximum check they can write, to be clear. as for the questions, for the most part, they're similar, but the framing, of course, is totally different. America is increasingly an urban and diverse nation, and concerns of people of color, structural racism, for example, questions like that, urban transportation issues, urban school issues. Clearly, these do not come up in questions in Iowa and New Hampshire, and I think we're going to begin to hear that more often, but it was interesting in the New Hampshire debate that there was such a lengthy discussion about racism.
Well, Diane, it's a great question and one that we'll certainly be watching. Andy, go ahead.
I think the biggest issue is that in the states after New Hampshire, these candidates are not really going to get asked many questions by the voters because
it's a very
different campaign after this. It becomes much more of a big rallies and talking to the press and campaign ads on television than it is kind of the thing that we're used to here. I also just say about New Hampshire, we like to pat ourselves on the back that we can see every candidate if we want to. Most of us don't. Most people do hear from other people or from the media about what candidates.
And a shout out for poll workers. Thanks for doing it.
Yes,
yeah,
indeed.
Diane, absolutely. And since you mentioned it, James, you know, Elizabeth Warren calling for unity. We heard earlier Bernie Sanders calling for unity. Everybody called for this last night. But let's hear Elizabeth Warren talking about this. She had a disappointing night after a very big, strong, long, extended ground game here in the Granite State. She came in fourth and a pretty far fourth as well. But let's hear from Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
If we're going to beat Donald Trump in November, we are going to need huge turnout within our party. And to get that turnout, we will need a nominee that the broadest coalition of our party feels like they can get behind. Now look, we cannot afford to fall into factions. We can't afford to squander our collective power. We win when we come together.
That's Elizabeth Warren last night after finishing fourth place at about 9 or 10%. James, who is that message aimed at? We cannot afford to fall into factions.
If you are still making up your mind, you're not sure where you're going to go, I'm a good second choice for you. The problem is multifold for Elizabeth Warren right now. By every measure, this was supposed to be her best state, if you look at the map. Not only historically does she share a media market, and the Massachusetts politicians do very well in a New Hampshire primary, and she walks out of this without a single delegate, but this is a state that sets records for voting for women in office. They found someone else in Amy Klobuchar yesterday. She spent the time here. She put the organization here. Again, the state is naturally inclined to vote for her. And so where she goes from here, I don't even know what the argument is, and particularly at a time when Democrats want electability. Let's just be, I'll be very quick on this. She's not the progressive option right now. That's Bernie Sanders. She's not the moderate option right now. That is Amy Klobuchar. She's not the unity candidate that she claims to be, because the crossover appeal is Pete Buttigieg. Where does she fit here?
Andy?
I agree. I think that there's really not a path for her. She, as a New England candidate, she had to demonstrate that she was going to be able to win here. Sanders, obviously, is the New England candidate coming out of New Hampshire. I don't see where Elizabeth Warren goes from this point. I really don't see that she has a path to winning the nomination, with the exception if there's just a bloodbath between everybody else and she manages to keep herself clean. But I just don't think that she has it. And she all, her funding also started to dry up pretty heavily in the fourth quarter of 2019. She's going to have an extremely difficult time raising any money to go on.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about Amy Klobuchar. Jeffrey in Portsmouth emails, I noticed that in their remarks to supporters, Warren, Buttigieg, and Sanders talked about unifying the party against the forces of evil, whereas Amy Klobuchar talked about unifying the country through a coalition of Democrats, independents, and moderate Republicans. That's what we wanted to hear, Jeffrey says, and that's why she excelled. Jeffrey, thank you for that note, and let's hear a little bit from Amy Klobuchar talking about that last night.
I cannot wait to win the nomination. I cannot wait to build a movement and win with a movement of fired up Democrats, of independents and moderate Republicans that see this election as we do.
Again, that's Amy Klobuchar, Minnesota senator, with that big surprise win last night. And James Pindle, we had an emailer earlier who said, hey, why aren't you guys talking more about Sanders? Why is everybody talking about Klobuchar? But as you said earlier, that's the big story. She went from almost not even finishing in Iowa, way down there, to coming in third with 20% here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I mean, Iowa was the one that was supposed to give us clarity on Amy Klobuchar more than any other candidate. She was either going to come out of Iowa, her neighboring state, where she spent a lot of time and a lot of focus, either with a lot of momentum or she was going to drop out. That was pretty clear. She was the one candidate where we definitely have clarity out of Iowa, but we didn't have clarity out of Iowa. And so she came in on Tuesday and a week ago and was trying to figure out, well, where do I exactly fit in this space? And she was about 6% in the New Hampshire polls. Okay, that's fine, kind of middling around. She wasn't a loser by any means, but she was not a front runner. The debate changed everything, and to see her dramatic rise over the weekend is one of those classic New Hampshire stories now.
Well, and Andy, maybe it's
time. I mean, honestly, it kind of surprised her.
Maybe it's time to dispense with this neighboring state advantage narrative. I mean, Elizabeth Warren, you know, came in at a disappointing fourth last night. She's in a neighboring state. Amy Klobuchar didn't do well in Iowa, as James said. That was a neighboring state for her. So maybe we should just get rid of this.
I don't think you can, because Bernie Sanders actually won from a neighboring state. And there's been times before where we've had two candidates from neighboring states. You can think of 2004, where you had Howard Dean and John Kerry, still a New Englander won. And I think the reason that the neighboring state is there is important. It's not because the candidates are better known. It's really because the kind of voters you have in, say, in Massachusetts in the Democratic Party are very similar to Democrats in New Hampshire, and it's easier to campaign with those people. Secondly, you can bring your kind of campaign organization from the neighboring state to knock on doors and do that sort of get out the vote effort at the end. And then finally, a big advantage is you can go home and sleep in your own bed. And psychologically, that's a really important thing when you get to this point in the campaign where there's a real grind going on. Just be able to be normal.
What do you think, James?
It matters less in Iowa, where you don't share media markets, than here in New Hampshire, where you do. But the historical record is a historical record. I think we're now at something like 8 out of 9 times that a candidate from New England has run, they have won.
Candidate from New England.
Has won the New Hampshire primary. It's the record, including last night.
Okay. Well, let's go back to our listeners. And Ron's in Concord. Hi, Ron. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, good morning, Laura.
Morning.
So everybody's tired. To the extent that we're going to have a primary 4 years or beyond that in New Hampshire, it seems like the conventional strategic wisdom has been turned on its ear, because the organizations that invested a lot didn't reap a lot of positive results, And it's all about timing this energy and this surge, some of which you can control, but much of which you can't.
I appreciate the point. I'd love to hear your thoughts, Andy.
Well, I agree that the momentum you get is really important, but typically the momentum comes from winning Iowa and then goes into New Hampshire. But it also points out something that the press are looking for some change at the end, and there's a certain herd journalism that goes on. And when Amy Klobuchar was seen as the winner in that debate on Friday night rather than Saturday night this time around, but when she's seen as the winner in that debate, the coverage for the next several days was how well Amy Klobuchar did. Is this going to be the change for her? And those voters that make up their minds at the end, and this time around, almost 40% of Democrats said they made up their mind in the last 3 days. That's the message that they're going to hear. And when Biden's collapse and Klobuchar ability to kind of fill that gap, I think that's why you see this momentum. It's happened before, actually routinely in New Hampshire, that there's an event at the end that seems to shake things up, and you just want to have that happen when you can take advantage of it.
Timing is so important, isn't it?
As in life.
Yeah.
I like to say this is the most magical 8 days in American politics between Iowa and New Hampshire, and New Hampshire lived up to it one more time, largely because of this very story. Organization is all that matters in Iowa. Here, it's something else.
All right, let's go back to our listeners. Thank you for that call. And to David in Munsonville. Hi, David. You're on the air. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you. I just thought we could spend 1 second talking about the Republican primary. I woke up this morning and saw 9% for Bill Weld, which was much higher than I was expecting anyway. And, you know, as a moderate Republican, who would vote for another party candidate if they're in the middle lane. Just wonder what you saw in those results for Bill Weld.
Well, I appreciate you calling in, and go ahead, Andy.
Trump almost matched the New Hampshire record for vote by an incumbent. Ronald Reagan in 1984 got 86.3%. Trump got 85.5%. So Trump did extremely well in the Republican primary. There are always people who aren't going to like a presidential a president within a party, but this is really an indication that it is Donald Trump's party, and people on the Republican side are unified behind Trump.
Let's take another one. This is Kim in Allenstown. Go ahead, Kim. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. Given that New Hampshire has a large percentage of independent voters, I was just wondering what the breakdown was of which party independent voters went with.
Very interesting. Thank you, Kim, for putting that on the table. James, do you know?
Well, the Democrats had the action. I believe he's got the exit poll numbers in front of him, but I think it was like half of the, roughly half, wasn't it?
It was just
of,
under
of
half.
The Democratic electorate were independent voters, which was interesting.
Yeah, just under half were undeclared ballot. Because they're really not independents. And the truth be told, they don't make that much of a difference in the election because they essentially behave the same way that registered Democrats
election.
Do. And even in primaries, no candidate, including this year, has ever won their party's primary without winning the plurality of their party. Registered voters. This idea that there's this big block of independents out there that are free-thinking people that are completely different than everybody else is just never proven to be the case. The thing, though, with those undeclared voters, they tend not to have been as focused as they don't pay as much attention to politics as our registered Democrats or registered Republicans, largely because they're older and have voted more often.
I got a couple emails to that effect as well. Bob and Lee sent a note. He says, members of one political party could organize its members to temporarily switch their registration just for the primary in order to favor the opposing party candidate that they think will be the easiest to defeat in the general election. This would be a strategic move in our first-in-the-nation primary. Bob writes, in my town of Lee, voters can immediately change back their registration on the way out of the voting place. Do the registrars of the vote keep records to show how many voters switch party affiliation before and after they vote in a primary? Now, to Bob's point, you can't just walk into the polls on election day and say, today I feel like a Democrat or a Republican. You have to do it back in October.
So,
but his point is well taken. You could, if you were a Republican and you wanted to get involved in the Democratic primary, you could do what Bob suggests, but not so easily as he makes it sound. Right, James?
Right. Number one, there was some talk about Republicans encouraging that. The president even talked about it, and the state party chair talked about it. But in theory, you probably could. You'd have to do that several weeks ago, or I guess a couple months ago. Number two, you could, I guess, if you were in theory a Republican who hasn't registered to vote yet, do that. but that's a very small percentage. There's no indication that this happened at any wide scale. Note in the last point to his question, yes, they do keep records on all of this.
Okay. Andy?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. If you were a registered Republican, you would have had to change your registration to undeclared back in October before the filing period started. There really is no evidence. I've seen looking
of
at
so-called mischief voting.
Of mischief voting. The most I've been able to figure out from both polling and looking at voting records is that maybe 3% or 5% are people who could vote in one primary, one cycle, and a different primary, the second cycle. It's hard enough to get people to come out and vote in your own party's primary, let alone in the other party's primary.
Well, I really appreciate the question because it is something that comes up a lot. And let's go to Bonnie in Bedford. Hi, Bonnie. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Via. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a longtime listener, sustaining supporter.
Great.
So here's my concern. My concern is in 2016, the polling got things wrong. Trump won. We thought Clinton was a shoo-in, so to speak. And if you're listening to things lately going into our primary, you would have thought Biden was going to take it by all stretches of the imagination. He came in fifth. So my concern is going into 2020, inaccurate polling and what gets presented, even though I've been hearing about the nationalization rather than a local perspective on what's happening in the election cycle. But that was really inaccurate. And promoting Biden the way we did on, you know, news shows and pundits came in fifth. So how do we know the polling going forward and what's going to be presented, even on, you know, NPR, so to speak, is going to be accurate and have the influence? Because Biden came in fifth.
Well, Bonnie, really am glad you asked this question. And we've got Andy Smith here, director of the UNH Survey Center. So go ahead, Andy.
Well, first off, the polls in New Hampshire never really predicted Biden to do well at all. He stopped being a front runner here in our polling going back in the fall and the summer this last year.
But nationally, she's right. The narrative was Biden, front runner.
National polling is predictive of essentially nothing. Through 2007, Rudy Giuliani led all of the national polls. And we remember Giuliani's stunning campaign.
So only pay attention
here
to the UNH poll.
No, it's pay attention to the early state poll because
sure,
there are actually campaigns going on there. Nobody's really paying that much attention to this nomination process nationwide. And what happens in the early states sets the framework and the perception of the other candidates. And I think we're already seeing it. Bernie Sanders now is leading in the national polls because now there's votes cast. Voters basically want a winner for their candidate in November. And how do you tell you got a winner? Well, they win.
Well, I think Bonnie's point is well taken. And I hear you, Andy. So the UNH poll, the Boston Globe, maybe Suffolk, Quinnipiac, those are more locally based polls who are talking to people who are seeing these candidates right here. So why do we even have these national polls if they're not worth very much?
I'll answer that for Andy.
Poor Andy, it's frustrating.
Andy
for
may
him.
Not want to be able to answer that. Look, we have national media organizations that already pay for a national poll, so they do it. But by definition, it means 1 out of 12 people will be in California who are not seeing ads or not seeing candidates. The campaign's not there. They might as well be in Canada.
Wow. Okay. Well, Bonnie, really appreciate the question. Thank you very much. Coming up after a break, we'd love more of your thoughts, reactions. What surprised you last night? What disappointed you? What pleased you? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, we're looking back at last night's presidential primary results in New Hampshire and where the candidates go from here. And of course, let's bring your voice into our conversation, your reaction to what happened, what you're happy with, what you're less happy with from those results last night. Let us know by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Tom in Exeter writes us to ask, Terry Gross had McKay Coppins of The Atlantic on yesterday. They were discussing a massive war of disinformation that Trump and Republicans are planning. I was wondering if your guests had any thoughts on who of the remaining candidates might be able to withstand the brazen lies, Tom says, which may be coming between now and November. And are any of the Democrats or the DNC thinking about this yet? Tom, thank you very much. I'd like to pivot, gentlemen, to the race ahead in this segment of our show. So I appreciate the email. And James, what do you think?
in this primary or the general election?
Well, let's take both.
Okay. Look, I think right now, I just did a, while voters were voting in New Hampshire, I was doing a deep dive on Nevada and the next state, where the Stop Bernie movement actually may happen, and they'll use unions to do it. It may be quite fascinating. In terms of, is the DNC preparing? Look, I mean, we're headed to another probably misinformation campaign. I'm not going to say there's going to be blame on all sides. Clearly, there's going to be blame on more than on largely one side on this right now, the way things are headed. The question is whether or not voters now are aware enough and they're used to seeing whatever is on Facebook to be highly skeptical. So there is the candidates. There is what you read in the media. And then there's this whole other world of disinformation, which continues to drive a lot of conversation, even when you're just talking to regular voters.
Well, and speaking of disinformation, Nancy from Durham wrote us. She says, my impression is that many Bernie supporters feel the party establishment, the media, and the DNC are actively working against Sanders' candidacy and perhaps even rigging elections. Nancy says sometimes their concerns sound like they are at least partially grounded in conspiracy theories. Can you please comment on the validity of their concerns? So lots of people just wondering what's true and what isn't. Thank you, Nancy.
I think there's a lot of evidence that the Democratic Party really doesn't want Bernie Sanders. I think going back to 2016, it was very clear that Hillary Clinton controlled the levers of power within the Democratic Party. It's much less so this time around, I think. I think it was a much fairer playing field. But that perception is going to linger on, because if it happened once, there's always a chance that it might happen again, and certainly among the Sanders supporters. I would say also, though, to a larger point about disinformation, campaigns are largely, have always been disinformation campaigns. They want to convince people that this view of the world is different than their opponent's view of the world, and they will use pieces of information to try to shape those impressions. What's true or what's not is really up to the voter to decide.
Well, it's interesting, and for example, that Wall Street Pete chant that some of the Sanders supporters make, you pointed out, James, that Pete Buttigieg may get support from Wall Street types, but there are limits on what people can contribute.
And he's the poorest candidate in the race, as he likes to point out. His house is significantly less expensive than other people in the race.
Well, and looking ahead to Nevada and South Carolina, I want to play a little bit now from Pete Buttigieg. We haven't played anything from him yet this hour. And in this clip we're going to hear, he clearly seems to have his eye on the next state.
And we can say to a dreamer, lying awake at night, questioning if this country is her own, celebramos tu pertenencia en este país, y si este país es tu país también. This country is your country too.
So Andy Smith, Pete Buttigieg pulling out a little Spanish there, mentioning immigration, which was not talked about in the final days of this campaign. What do you think?
He's going into a different electorate. The biggest hit on him, and what he took the biggest shots for, shot on in the debate on Friday night, is that he is too white. He doesn't represent minorities. He's had some difficulties with minorities in South Bend, and he's trying to come up with a way to get around that. Actually, it was kind of weird. In the last couple of days, he changed his stump speech to really focus on race, and it was kind of awkward, I think. I think it was thrown in because of this concern that this is a weakness within his campaign. So obviously, from this clip, he understands that and is hoping to shape things going forward.
I heard a couple other candidates talk about that last night, more so than they have during the campaign here in New Hampshire. So clearly looking ahead to Nevada and South Carolina. Let's take Mark in Orford. Hi, Mark. Thank you for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to go back to the comment about the herding of the media. Kovachar, when you stand back and look at her and her senatorial position, the stuff that she has done in her state and in the Judiciary Committee hearings on Kavanaugh, outstanding and clear, and yet the media, especially the national media, including NPR and PBS, would concentrate on a couple of names, and there was good reason to mention her as well, but they didn't, and they didn't, and they didn't, and it was only that sort of punching above the where we were comment in Iowa that seemed to attract some tension and get a little bit of comment.
So, Mark, you sound happy with the results last night. Did you vote for Klobuchar, if I may ask?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, actually we did. And Linda Fowler's op-ed piece in the Valley News made the difference for us because it coalesced the reasons and her experience in winning basically every district in Minnesota.
Okay. Well, Mark, thank you for calling in. Yeah, and, you know, he mentioned the Valley News and op-eds, and Amy Klobuchar got a lot of editorial endorsements. Now, we've talked a lot, James Pindle, about whether these matter or not, but it's never a bad thing to have a whole bunch of papers say this is the candidate to vote for.
No, sure, it's not. How much of an impact it has on the positive side, that's dubious. But he mentions Linda Fowler, of course, I guess she's retired now, maybe, at Dartmouth, a political science professor there. Amy Klobuchar wasn't mentioned throughout much of this campaign because she was unable to build much of a campaign until the very last few days here in New Hampshire. She did not have the money. She did not have the organization. She was not a national brand like, say, Elizabeth Warren was or Bernie Sanders or the vice president was. So she really, this has been a remarkable story. It's only a New Hampshire story in a way to how we kind of launched her into the ether here.
Well, and what does she do from here? Because other candidates seem to have more volunteers, staff, money, ads, social media. They kind of have something set up in those future states. Amy Klobuchar, you know, is she going to be able to gear up that quickly?
This is very hard. I just want to there's been a lot of discussion of that, too. She's going to have to, what's the phrase? You're going to have to build an airplane while you're in there. and she will. But I think we should step back while acknowledging this is going to be a very tough path forward for her. The astonishing rise of her in the last week is a remarkable story.
I want to ask one more time, gentlemen, we touched on this earlier, but what happened to Joe Biden? One of our callers earlier pointed out that correctly that a lot of national polls, and Andy, you made the case that these national polls aren't really worth very much, but still a lot of them did call Joe Biden the quote unquote front runner. What's your take on just what happened to Joe Biden in New Hampshire?
I would say
fifth place.
There are several things that happened, but they're earlier on structural things. First, he was not able to raise money. When you're the former vice president, you're getting outraised consistently by the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. That's a serious problem. Secondly, he was the vice president. He was unable to really get very many endorsements from people within the Democratic Party. Everybody was waiting on the sidelines to see what happened. Third, if you went to a Biden event here in New Hampshire, there was very little enthusiasm, very little energy, very small crowds. And Biden didn't really perform well as a candidate. So I would say that if you saw Biden and a Biden campaign event last summer, you would have had a very different expectation, much like he finished here. Would I have predicted that he finished fifth here back in September? No. But would I have predicted that he would finish maybe third? Yes.
Fifth with just 8% of the vote. And again, it was a pretty stunning development yesterday when Vice President Biden got on a plane, went to South Carolina. The voting wasn't even done here in New Hampshire. He spoke to his New Hampshire supporters by video conference from South Carolina. Let's hear a little bit about what the former vice president said.
And I've said it from the moment I entered this race, as Val mentioned, we are in the battle for the soul of the nation. Now Jill and I are moving on to Nevada and South Carolina and beyond. And we want you all to know how much we appreciate everything you've done, truly from the bottom of our hearts. And so many of you become friends. Look, we're going to be back. We're going to be back in New Hampshire. We're going to be back there to defeat Donald Trump in November, elect Jeannie the next senator again, and up and down the ticket. So don't go away. You're not getting rid of us. We're coming back, and we love you.
Okay, so that's Joe Biden again speaking to New Hampshire supporters from South Carolina. Got an email from Molly who says, I worked at a rally and at the polls. I was interviewed three times and had a long off-the-record conversation with a reporter. My takeaway, Molly says, beyond why Amy, these outlets seemed driven to find friction and controversy. I was asked, do you believe a woman can be president? Three different ways, New Hampshire shined a light on Amy Klobuchar, an authentic moderate. Molly, thank you so much. So I'm asking two men this question, but what about those sort of rumblings that I heard from New Hampshire voters? They would say to me, I have no problem voting for a woman myself, but I'm concerned that those people in Michigan and, you know, Minnesota and Ohio won't vote for a woman.
Well, first of all, Molly, thanks for being engaged. Absolutely. This is what New Hampshire does really well. And for all of the criticism the state gets, the one thing that we have to note is that people know about the elections. They know the candidates. And then oftentimes they go so far as to being like Molly and they volunteer and they work in the polls. And that's great. And they are willing to talk to reporters. One dynamic that is really overall played in this election is voters as pundits. They are not trying to figure out where they stand and how they think about candidates. They're trying to figure out some mythological person in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin and how they will vote.
Someone you've never met, never talked to. You have no idea where they stand, what their life background
is. That's right. And on one sense, that means Democrats really mean it and they are focused on beating Trump and focused on beating them in those states that flipped to Trump and gave him the presidency. On the other hand, it leads to a lot of deep questions about, well, I don't know. I mean, who is the most electable in Pennsylvania? Was it that person or is it that person or is it that person? And then it leads to questions about gender. And one of the more stunning things when Elizabeth Warren first got in the race, we would do a poll. And my favorite thing to do, probably in my job, is to talk to folks who take the poll. Because you get to, it's very, you can, they're coded, you know who they are, and you can have an in-depth conversation about why they think what they think. And I was pretty stunned about the number of particular women who were concerned that maybe a woman is not the person who can beat Trump, and they just want to beat Trump. That was kind of a stunning thing to me.
Even though Hillary Clinton won the popular vote.
She sure did.
So even women are saying, I'm not sure a woman could win. Of course, I don't mind voting for a woman, they say, but I'm worried about what those Pennsylvanians or
voters
Wisconsin
as pundits.
Residents
exactly
will
right.
do. Wow, that seems perilous, Andy. Again, we don't know how these people feel. We've never talked to them.
Well, part of this, I think, is the in 2020 is fallout from the 2016 election.
The Hillary hangover, I've heard it called.
The Clinton campaign made a tremendous number of tactical mistakes in that campaign, and I don't think they really wanted to face up to the weaknesses that they – the bad decisions that they made within the campaign. It's a lot easier to say that, well, people couldn't vote for a woman. And I don't think that's the case. You were hearing a lot of these same arguments made in 2008 that people just wouldn't vote for an African-American. And states like New Hampshire, which are overwhelmingly white, how could they vote for an African-American up here? But they did. So I don't think that voters are paying as much attention to these characteristic issues about candidates as much as they are to the partisanship in a general election for more than anything. And then second, the issue positions they have. And then thirdly, the kind of vision that that person has for the country. I don't think it's the personal pieces about them that is as important.
So it's a lot more complicated, Andy, than, oh, the country isn't quote-unquote ready for a woman.
Yeah. Women voters and men voters, especially in the Democratic Party, they want the same thing. They want to beat Donald Trump. It's not really an issue of gender so much.
All right. Well, let's take one more call. And let's go to Elsa in Antrim. Go ahead, Elsa. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to say I found this election the weirdest I've ever been to.
Weirdest?
I'm
okay, Elsa.
I'm 71 years old. I've been voting since I was probably 18 or 20. Huge ballot, hard to find who you wanted to vote for. And I drove through town 3 times during the day for various reasons. Absolutely nobody out front with placards.
Okay, so kind of quiet there in Antrim.
There was nothing to even indicate that we were supposed to vote.
All right.
I found that very strange.
That is interesting, and I had the opposite feeling living in Concord, but maybe that's different. Lots of people on the corners waving signs and beeping horns and so forth. I was having a cup of coffee downtown before I came into work, and this huge crowd of people from out of state were here canvassing for. It was kind of nice. It was a group of about 10 young people. Some of them were Biden people. Some of them were Bernie people. Some of them were Klobuchar people. And they'd all just driven up here from New York to rally for their prospective candidates. I did want to thank you, Elsa, for the call. I did want to ask you guys about Michael Bloomberg. Could we call him the ghost of Christmas future? Kind of not on the ballot, but a phantom presence. Can you talk about that, Andy?
Well, he wasn't on the ballot here in New Hampshire, but he still made his presence very well known. As you know, Dixville Notch gets to vote first, so they vote at midnight. They only had 5 voters this year, and Bloomberg won, I believe, 3 of those voters on a write-in campaign.
Oh, my
goodness.
He
won both the Democratic
okay.
and the Republican primary.
And the way he was able to do that, he personally called every one of the voters in that state, in Dixville Notch. That is a great piece of political strategy because that was the news that came out at midnight. It was covered in the morning because there weren't any other votes coming in. Great way to get a few phone calls and you were able to get drive a lot of media coverage.
Somebody really gave him good advice on that one. That's really interesting, Andy.
Well,
James?
It ties into the caller's point. This was a weird primary. And, and if you want to talk about the nationalization of the primary or the idea that in New Hampshire you have to show up, you cannot buy elections. And then it's a perfect start of the New Hampshire primary that Michael Bloomberg, who never showed up to run for president, skipped the state and certainly buying his way onto the debate stage.
And is he showing up in Nevada or South Carolina or not?
He's skipping the first four states.
Okay, he's not on those ballots
either. He's
starting
Super Tuesday 3 weeks from now.
Okay, very interesting. Lots of fodder for political reporters, political scientists, pollsters. Gentlemen, thank you so much. It was a big day yesterday, a long night. I really appreciate you coming in. Andy, great to see you.
Thank you very much.
Andy Smith, director of the UNH Survey Center, professor of practice in political science at UNH. James Pindle, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe. And you've been listening to The Exchange. It's a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Thanks for being with us, everyone. I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.